minds aglow with whirling, transient nodes of thought, careening through a cosmic vapor of invention.
Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be listening to the second half of a talk by Jaron Lanier, a pioneer of virtual reality. In this half of the talk, Lanier elaborates his ideas about virtual reality permitting communication without language. Lanier spoke to the Yale Working Group on Artificial Intelligence, Nanotechnology, and Transhumanism on October the 2nd, 2002. You can listen to the first half of the talk at changesurfer.com.
It's possible to imagine creatures with channels between them that are different than ours. So an enormous early step was the initiation of verbal language, as I'm using now. But then there was reading and writing and printing and all the McLuhan-esque items that we're familiar with, and, of course, digital technology and all of this. And you can view these as being part of a ramp in which more and more channels between people are opened up across time, across the world, across cultures. If we're going to understand the technological progress ramp as one of increased varieties of connection, can we imagine an ultimate destiny for it? Well, that ultimate destiny for ramp in those terms is precisely the utopian vision of virtual reality that I was referring to when I made up the term a long time ago. The notion of virtual reality was initially that we could use technology to imagine a form of connection between people in which every aspect of the sensorum, every aspect of the world as experienced, could be a part of spontaneous communication. So another way to say this is it was a way of imagining a form of dreaming that was shared, that was objective, and that was intentional, like a conversation, and simultaneous between people. Post-symbolic communication. Nobody knows what natural language is. Let's say that despite of all of our arguments about what natural language is or is not, none of us really know how it works. We can't reproduce it with a machine. We're not sure what it is. So I don't want to pretend that I've cracked the nature of natural language, something fundamentally not understood. But let us say that whatever it is, I'm going to use the term symbolic to refer to its ability to allow weird sounds coming out of this bizarre orifice that I happen to have stuck on my face to refer to all variety of things. Here I am just moving this little shape around, and I've been speaking about all manner of odd things before you. So that ability to get a narrow variety of things like mouth sounds to refer to a broad range of other things in reality is what I will call symbolic. So I'm going to use the broadest possible definition of it rather than a formal definition. And if I call that symbolic, I think in the reality conversation modality that I was hypothesizing might someday exist just now, I can imagine something that we could call post-symbolic. And in post-symbolic communication, people would directly create whatever it is the conversation is about rather than referring to it. Now, you might say, but it's a virtual world. It's still a reference to something. Well, no, not really. I mean, you can really make things. And this becomes a whole long discussion in itself. I'll just give you the tiniest little peephole peek into what these discussions can look like if you're interested in starting to think about post-symbolic communication. Let us suppose that there's some honorary linguist in the room who says, wait a second, how can you talk about abstraction? You know, how do you have categories? How do you do any of this stuff if everything's very concrete and you're just making individual objects to communicate? So let's take a category. Let's talk about red stuff. So in symbolic communication, we have the concept of red, the word red, variations on it. In post-symbolic communication, I could just whip up and pull out from behind me a little object maybe about this big, just big enough for your head to fit inside. You stick your head inside it, and inside you see inclusively every red thing in the universe floating there out to infinity. Now, this is a new kind of red. It's neither the abstract or category-like red that we're used to in language, nor is it a particular, nor does it have particularity of being a single red thing. Rather, it demonstrates inclusively the totality of the class in a concrete way. And so the notion is that, now whether one would ever actually do this, of course, I don't know, but the point of that mental exercise is to say that you could imagine that if you have sufficiently facile, fluid, mastery of tangibles, of concrete things, you can express a range similar to what we rely on abstraction to bring us now. Now, I say similar, I doubt it's coincident. I suspect that post-symbolic communication will encompass areas that I don't know how to think about or point to yet, because they're not pointable at. They're non-symbolic. And I also suspect that symbolic communication covers territory that post-symbolic communication would be deaf or blind to. But I don't know, of course. And one of the things I want to emphasize is that in my mind, whatever adventure might ensue along these lines is something that we have to think about on the scale of centuries, at the very least. It's inconceivable that any progress could be made on creating such a form of communication in our lifetimes. It's a very long-range adventure. And as I'll argue, having adventures on that sort of time frame, I think, is absolutely crucial for our times, to provide a better framework for thinking about technology than the artificial intelligence framework. And indeed, this particular vision is my answer to the Turing test. It might be a bit harder to express, and yet I think it is humanistic and provides better answers to immediate design questions than the Turing test does. I want to emphasize again that we do not know what natural language is. One project I have worked on in the last 5 years is creating a biomimetic neural network that can take apart the components of a face. So this is in collaboration with Christoph von der Marsberg at USC, and we have a system that you can point at an arbitrary person's face and it'll find 60 points on it and track them as a person makes different expressions, and we can identify some of the classic supposedly unfakeable aspects of emotional affective display. One way to distinguish affective presentation from the use of symbols, let me say, might be in terms of information bandwidth. In that point, your mode of perception shifts from a symbolic lookup sort of operation to a pattern detection in which there's no explicit breakdown to sort of a low bandwidth representation. So if you detect an affect from me, you can respond to it without there being a word for that affect at any level of representation within either of our brains. It might never become condensed. It might never become a low bandwidth channel of communication. It might always remain high bandwidth. And I think that that's where there's a distinction between affective and symbolic communication. Let me just say a little bit about virtual worlds and affective communication, because this is interesting. In a virtual world, there's a thing called an avatar, which is the way you look inside the virtual world to other people. And I made the first one, and we did a lot of interesting experiments with it. And very, very low bandwidth avatars are extraordinary. You really have a sense of the person just because of the incredible amount of information that's embedded in such things as head motion and eye motion. You know, now, if you start to have more channels, let's suppose you can convey a few hundred points of measurement from a person's body to the avatar, things get very interesting. But one thing that's extremely important is you can change the nature of the avatar utterly and maintain the effective channel of communication. So if you can become a lobster, you can become a weird alien or something, and the effective channel continues through. It really doesn't seem to be particularly tied to your morphology.
Today on Change Surfer Radio, we're listening to the second half of a talk that Jaron Lanier delivered to the Yale Working Group on Artificial Intelligence, Nanotechnology, and Transhumanism on October the 2nd, 2002. Jaron Lanier is a pioneer of virtual reality.
So in the first part of the talk, I presented my little oversimplification, my melodrama of black hats and white hats. And towards the end of that presentation, someone asked me, why is this opposition important? Is there any great peril in getting this wrong? And I think there is. And I'd like to discuss a bit about that in the next section of the talk. to evoke the ramp of technological development once again. One way in which to view it, as I pointed out before, is as an increase in human power, the human ability to manipulate the environment. And seen in that light, of course, climbing up the ramp puts us in great peril because we gain the power to destroy ourselves, a power that we didn't have before. That's a state we first achieved in the mid-20th century with the development of nuclear weapons, in particular with their proliferation and with the development of intercontinental missiles. And knock on wood, I'm happy to have a real wooden table here to knock upon, we did not annihilate ourselves in the course of the first period of living with the ability to do so. So this is a great achievement to celebrate, but of course it's only a blink in the eye, and we have to wonder whether we can sustain this achievement and not destroy ourselves. As we climb further and further up the ramp, there are more and more technological strategies available for mass destruction. Now, what I want to talk about is how climbing up the ramp changes the setting for existential dilemmas. How does it affect the way we think about life and death? How does it affect our choices of whether to become suicidal or not? I often tell my students that I work in a few different areas, and when I have students who are making technologically oriented either design or art, I tell them that their sacred duty is to design technology that's sufficiently entrancing as to seduce people away from mass suicide. It's a very specific goal. It's a goal of a specificity that has not been available before. I think we're in a peculiar time in which, just as we have this extraordinary accelerating deluge of technological and scientific advancements and escalating rhetoric about them of all sorts, we also have what, so far as I can tell, is a unique concurrence of vicious forms of fundamentalism in all the world's religious traditions at the same time, and all on the rise. So we haven't had, I'll start with Judaism since I'm Jewish myself. We haven't had Judaism of the kind we see in some of the settlers since Roman times. That's something we just haven't had for a long time, and it's frightening. We've had Buddhist mass suicide terror cults such as the sarin gas bombers in Tokyo. We have, of course, the Hindu fundamentalists. Islam is in the most stressed state it's ever been, perhaps. Christianity has also produced a series of suicidal, homicidal cults in the United States in recent times, such as the David Koresh cult and the People's Temple cult and so forth. And these things exist on a significant scale. And of course these things have popped up from time to time, but I would argue that the concurrence is unusual and represents a phenomenon that's worthy of note in its own right. I could be wrong about that because we only have a sample of one for experiencing our times. We can't run history back again and see until more history goes by, it'll be hard to tell what was really important or special about our time. So it's very hard to make these judgments. So my sense is that there is something pretty special going on. So a question to ask is why? Why is this all going on now? The argument I want to put forward is that it's a response to intimate threats on the nature of personhood brought about by advances in science and technology, and also in particular by the rhetoric that surround those advances as put forward by many of the scientists and technologies who create them, scientists and technologists. In the first part, I talked about artificial intelligence. And I talked about the rhetoric of the Turing test and of computers becoming people, which is an enormously, I would say, dominant line of thought in computer science departments in the academy and also in the military and elsewhere. There has been, I think, a similar sort of oversimplification and confusion of linear and nonlinear processes and unwarranted reductionism in the biological sciences, where, for instance, you'll see a headline about, a gene for novelty seeking or something like that. So you'll say, our personalities are really made of these genes. And now, of course, anyone who is familiar with the work will know that that is an oversimplification, that also it's very preliminary work, and also that undoubtedly when a full picture is known, it'll be more subtle and more complicated with many more qualifiers and all of that. And yet, we scientists and technologists feel, it seems, continuously drawn into this game of overstatement and oversimplification. And the reason why is economic, that we compete in the attention economy just like sports figures and movie stars. Our prestige and our funding is enormously enhanced to the degree we're noticed, and so we tend to come up with the snappiest rhetoric. I am absolutely guilty of playing that game, and I do it for my own career, and I'm sure many people in this room do it for theirs. And I would, in some ways, I enjoy doing it. I like doing it well. In other ways, I regret being part of the game. And it seems to have an effect of universally dumbing down everything. And yet, I don't know how to get out of it. So for whatever reason, the sciences are engaged in this sort of rhetoric that directly impinges on what we think of as personhood. Now, here, I'd like to introduce just a little mental device called the circle of empathy, and I think it makes an appearance in the Half Manifesto. The circle of empathy is a simple idea. It's a circle you draw around yourself, and within the circle are those things that you consider to be deserving of empathy, and outside of the circle are those things that you're willing to eat and stomp upon and burn for fuel and so forth. This is yet another tool for ordering history. You can think of some of the conflicts of the past as being questions of where to draw the circle. Some of the most dramatic ones have concerned which people should be inside the circle. So, of course, in our country, the formative debate was whether people with dark skin should be inside the circle or not. And fortunately, they have, for the most part, made it in, although it's still a little iffy in some places, but I think we're getting there. And I think in general, we have a modern consensus that human beings belong inside the circle. But some of the contentious objects that might or might not be inside the circle, depending on who you talk to these days, are fetuses, animals, and computers. Where some of my colleagues believe they have already achieved intelligence, or at least the Internet as a whole has achieved intelligence or something like that, and already deserve empathy. Now, the usefulness of the circle of empathy is that it's plain to see that if you attempt to extend the circle too far, to infinity, to include all of creation, you make yourself incompetent. There are many people who try to do this. There are traditions such as the Jains of India who do their best to do it, to live without murdering a bacteria inside their body, which is, of course, impossible. One can be a vegetarian in one direction but not in the other, meaning that one will become food for the worms eventually. So becoming a perfect vegetarian in a fully symmetrical sense is beyond our ability. And so there's a hopelessness to trying to extend the circle to infinity, and also an incompetence, a sort of a silliness that can come about. My sister's dating a feng shui dog consultant, you know. And I had to finally say, don't you realize that the culture that made up feng shui eats dogs? You know, let's, you know, that as new age as we want to be, there are just limits to it. The circle can only be stretched so far, and then it's impossible. So, what should be in, what should be out? I want to suggest that when you make the circle big, you can say a little bit in detail about the way there's a breakdown in your quality of thought, rather than just saying speaking generally. Now, here, let me say something that's perhaps a bit controversial in a campus environment where I don't know what's going on at Harvard these days. I mean, at Yale. This is Yale. I'm sorry. You know, the problem is you guys all look alike. So I don't know what's going on at Yale these days. Animal rights is a big thing at Princeton, where they just hired an animal rights philosopher, of course. But my perception during the 70s and 80s, as the animal rights movement was starting to become articulated for the first time, was that it did do harm to other rights movements, in particular to human civil rights movements. And the way it did so was not precisely by a linear diversion of attention, as if people had a certain allocation of empathy and some of it was stolen for animals, but rather the way it had an effect was by changing the nature of empathy itself. And so before the animal rights movement, the nature of empathy for, say, a person with dark skin might have been articulated as something like, boy, these people have the potential just like we do. They could have the same achievements, the same jobs, they could have the same lives. We're giving them this screwed up, these screwed up chances. We're denying them the ability to do things. And that framework of empathy is one that shows a sort of faith and expectation, and it's in a way sort of demands something of the object of the empathy. That shifted to all sentient beings deserve empathy, dog, chicken, person, which is a sort of a passive empathy, which expects nothing. That's an important difference. It's a different flavor of empathy. Now, in the Silicon Valley, back in the 1980s, there was a certain kind of cybernetic utopianism that started to be articulated by a variety of people who include, and they're all friends of mine, you know, this is like I disagree with them, but I love them, you know. So Eric Drexler, who made up the term nanotechnology, and a guy named Kevin Kelly, who wrote a book called Out of Control and the Rules, Seven Rules for New Business or something like that, and Stuart Brand, who made the Whole Earth Catalog, and a bunch of scientists and technologists that included, Hans Moravec and Ray Kurzweil more recently, and this whole crap, my zombie friends, okay? So they started to articulate an idea that in information systems, traditional value equations don't hold in the way they used to. That you're in a very drastic way not in the world of zero-sum games anymore. So in a zero-sum game, if I take something from you, you no longer have it. And then in a non-zero-sum game, I might take something from you, but as a result, something creative happens that creates all this wealth for everybody, and it's as if I'd given you something. And so a classic example of a non-zero-sum game from the point of view of the cybernetic utopians, not from the point of view of some other people very clearly, would be Napster, where the Silicon Valley point of view on Napster is, well, it wasn't... Sure, people were stealing files, but on the other hand, there's all this creativity and new music and new commerce and everything, and it creates much more wealth than it might sap, that the non-zero aspect is much more operative than the zero-sum aspect. In the case of Napster, actually, I think that that's probably correct. I think that that's the correct interpretation there. But I think the flaw in this particular utopianism was to believe that there would no longer be any zero-sum aspect, that everything would become non-zero-sum. Now, so the notion was that in the Internet, the Internet is this open structure, this network structure, and it's a non-zero-sum game. Every time you contribute, you give away something on it, you get more back because you've added to the value of the network. And a whole new economic theory was developed about this. And indeed, one of the practical technological effects is the thing called Moore's Law, where it does seem that the more you put into sort of connectionist technology, connected technologies, just they do seem to improve at exponential rates. And we have not only computers getting faster exponentially, but they're getting cheaper exponentially, and network bandwidth increases exponentially, and cost of memory goes down exponentially, and storage size increases exponentially. They're like all these exponents that are similar, and they all seem to arise out of this non-zero sense that each piece helps the whole, and that rather than fighting over pieces, we should be thinking in an entirely different way. So this led to this sort of ecstasy in this sense. There was a book called The Long Boom, which is an expression of this particular cybernetic euphoria that suggested that we would see ever-expanding, exponentially increasingly expanding wealth from here on out because of cybernetic connectionism and its extraordinary benefits. Now, I always had a different view back then. My feeling was that... we were slipping into the wrong kind of empathy, let's say, that we were starting to focus on, for instance, that this would create faster machines but wouldn't create better use of the machines, that there was a sort of a quantity-quality confusion inherent in this. Or, to put it another way, we might have faster, faster computers but the same old crappy hardware that actually... and software. So we actually, the inefficiency of software, the lugubriousness and difficulty of software actually is getting worse at the same rate at which the hardware gets faster, creating a rough constant of computer effectiveness in applications that are already known about, such as word processing. It's an interesting stasis. But But more importantly, I think, the rhetoric of cybernetic connectionist euphoria infected other fields. And I saw it leach into neoconservative economic thinking in the 80s, and it had a tremendous influence on the Reagan era. That was the first major, I think, transfer outside of the zone of computer science, perhaps. So this was the Laffer curve and all of these things, this notion that the zero sum is passed and that we should be thinking of non-zero formulations. And one of the particularly disheartening transfers of the idea happened more recently with the dot-com bubble, which is a very specific occurrence where you could really see the rhetoric from Bay Area, Silicon Valley, utopians moving into the sales rhetoric of people in Wall Street selling securities. And then you could see it moving into ethical lapses in the large companies. And here's the way it moves. If you really believe you're in a non-zero-sum game, there's no longer a categorical imperative, right? And that's a vital observation. If you believe that if I take from you, I actually am giving to you, so go ahead and take from me. You no longer the golden rule has turned to lead, and is no longer of much use. And I think that it is precisely that thinking, in their own words, that was going through the minds of some of the most egregious abusers of business ethics in the last few years, which has resulted in enormous harm. Now, I want to try to be very careful that I don't anytime someone becomes concerned about a particular thing, whatever it might be, you have a tendency to see all the world's problems filtered through your own particular concern. So, of course, I'm tempted to say if some milk went bad in the refrigerator, it's because of cybernetic totalism, and it influenced the refrigerator design so somebody didn't understand it or something. I mean, and it might even be true to a limited degree. I am a little bit in danger of being a little overly focused on my particular way of thinking. But I think in this case there is a problem, and what we have to get used to here is the complexity of the real world in which we simultaneously are living with layers that are zero sum and layers that are non-zero sum. Every technology of complexity, such as nanotechnology, where you have a lot of parts that must work together, or little nanorobots that are supposed to go inside your body someday and fix things. Actually, there's starting to be a few sort of mini robots anyway that go inside your body to fix things. Anything of complexity is limited by two factors, just like virtuality as I described it before. One is the gadgetry. Can we miniaturize things enough? Do we have the right materials and all of that? The other is the software. Can we write the software to control whatever this complicated thing is? There's every bit of evidence that on the first front, on miniaturizing and improving materials and having new gadgets, we're going to be fine. We just keep on getting better and better. So probably the fact that software continues to suck after all these years and doesn't seem to show any signs of improving, probably software will end up being the limiting factor for most of the transformative technologies that are talked about by utopians, including me.
Today on Change Surfer Radio, we were listening to the second half of a talk by Jaron Lanier, which he delivered at the Yale Working Group on Artificial Intelligence, Nanotechnology, and Transhumanism on October the 2nd, 2002. To listen to the first half, visit changesurfer.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.